This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Democrats are celebrating what looks like good news in their quest to reclaim the White House, but their aspirations have appeared to have fallen somewhat short, if not entirely short, in the Senate and in their House campaigns as well, where they lost states in the U.S. House. Meanwhile, in both Ohio and Kentucky, Democrats suffered significant setbacks. And we check in on both, starting with Ohio. We're joined from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau by Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. She's on the phone with us. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Glad you could be with us. And I believe reporter Joe Ingles is going to be joining us via Zoom. Not sure if she's there with us yet, but when she does join us, we've got some good chat ahead involving her. Karen, Ohio and, our surrounding states were not very much in play as the days went on, and we're watching places like Arizona and Pennsylvania, which I guess is technically a surrounding state. But what did we learn about Ohio on Election Day?
Well, I think that there was a thought that we were going to be in play, that we were going to be a battleground state again, because the polls were certainly showing that Ohio was in play. And I look back at the Quinnipiac poll, November 2nd, 2016, and it showed that Trump was going to win Ohio by 5 points with a margin of error of 4. And it turned out he won Ohio by 8. So Quinnipiac was right in 2016. This year, November 2nd, 2020, the poll had shown that Biden was going to win Ohio by 4 points with a margin of error of 2.9%. And that turned out to be wrong, completely wrong. And so I think that when we were looking at that and we were looking at the data that was coming out from boards of elections, I tweeted out an awful lot of this. Early voting data showing that Democratic-affiliated voters were flooding boards of elections with absentee ballot requests and were showing up to vote early in big numbers, that it looked like Ohio was indeed in play. And then the final result was almost the same as last time. I think that once the outstanding provisional and absentee ballots, about 311,000 are still out there and will be counted 10 days after the election. As those are counted, I think that the result is going to be very, very similar to what happened in 2016 when Donald Trump won Ohio by 8.3%, or 8.13%, rather.
Any reports of difficulties in voting across Ohio?
Not usually. I mean, we almost always see some sort of technical problem. Somebody, the power goes out somewhere, somebody forgets the keys and can't open the place or whatever. This time, the only major report I had heard was that electronic poll books that poll workers were using in Franklin County here in Columbus did not update with early voting information the night before the election. And so poll workers had to sign voters in with paper poll books, which, not a big deal. It just slowed down the lines a little bit. But other than that, no technical problems. My colleague Joe Ingles reported that there were some concerns that were raised by election protection advocates who were saying that some people were getting false information, some people were feeling intimidated, and they've been checking those out.
And we are still working to connect with Joe Ingles to talk a little bit more about this. But Karen, before the election, on Election Day, I believe you published a story about the Ohio counties that may give us some clues to watch about where the state might go. Some of those did not return in the blue column. It looks, if you look at the map of Ohio right now, the color-coded map based on the counties and how they went, whether red for President Trump or blue for Vice President Joe Biden, it looks like the only blue counties are where the bigger cities are. And then, of course, you have Athens County, where Ohio University is, and everything else is red.
Yeah, and that's pretty typical. I mean, Donald Trump won 80 Ohio counties in 2016. This time he apparently won 81, though I have to say that these are unofficial results we're talking about here. And there's still a question about Mahoning County, which was a Democratic county in 2016. Donald Trump picked it up this time, but there are still enough absentee and provisional ballots that have not been counted that could end up going back over to the Democratic side. But Joe Biden picked up Montgomery County, where Dayton is, and that was a county that voted for a Republican in 2016 for the first time since 1988. So it's interesting to see how the results are on this map, and I tweeted this map out a couple of days ago showing where the red is, where the blue is. And it's mostly red, but there are obviously blue counties right now, as I'm looking at it. Cuyahoga, Summit, Athens, Hamilton, Montgomery, and Lucas County are the blue counties this time around. And I'll tell you that it looks like Democrats were able to hold on to the gains that they made in the suburbs. But then the weakness that they showed, I guess, was in some of the other areas. Democrats did pick up a seat in the Cleveland area, pick up a seat in the Ohio State House in the Cleveland area, knocking off Republican Representative Dave Greenspan. But then they ended up losing seats in Southeast Ohio that had been held by a Democrat, and also a seat in Ashtabula County that had been held by a Democrat. Both those gentlemen were term limited. And they flipped a seat in Niles in the Youngstown area with an incumbent Democrat, Gil Blair from Niles. And so the net gain for Republicans was, you know, two seats, I guess.
And we're going to talk about the repercussions of that in just a moment. We're talking with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. And now we're also joined on the phone by OPR reporter Joe Ingles. Hi, Joe.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. I'm so glad that you could join us. And we were just talking a little bit about the way the map looks in 2020 based on the color-coded counties, red or blue for President Trump or Joe Biden, and it doesn't look too different than it did in 2016, but there are some key differences. You had profiled that political scientists are saying that Ohio is no longer a bellwether, a swing, or a battleground state. But as I look at this map, I think that it does look a lot like the country where there is this urban-rural divide in the way that they're voting in federal elections. Tell us more about what the political scientists told you about the status of Ohio.
Well, you're right. That urban-rural divide is definitely evident in Ohio. What the political scientists are saying, though, is that with the population changes we've had in the last 10 years, with the changes in political attitudes that we've had in the past 10 years, and with the way that Ohioans have voted in the last elections, those are all indications that Ohio is not necessarily like it used to be. It used to be that Ohio was kind of movable, and now they're saying it's more red. One thing that is kind of at stake here is if Joe Biden pulls out and wins the presidency, that puts Ohio as out of step with picking the president. And you think, well, why does that matter? Well, the reason that matters is for the past 60 years, Ohio has been a bellwether state, and our state has picked the president every single time. You have to go back to Nixon to find when we didn't do that. And when we no longer are a swing state, when we're no longer a bellwether state, if that's the way that we are perceived, and remember that the Democrats nationally did not treat Ohio as a swing state as they had 8 years ago. So not putting the amount of money in it, the time in it, and that sort of thing. So, you know, we didn't see the big candidate visits, like, you know, part of that is due to COVID. So let's put that on the table. But we didn't see the attention that we usually get. And I think there was already an inclination that Ohio was somewhat more red than you know.
And we're talking with Karen Kassler and Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Joe, we had talked a little bit about this with Karen, but you wrote about voter protection groups saying that there were some problems with Tuesday's election here in Ohio. Now that we're a few more days removed from that, are there any problems that are still lingering or that haven't been resolved? Do we still have Joe?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. There you go,
Joe. Can you
hear me now? Yes, yes.
Okay. We're having some connection problems.
Yeah, we are today.
There were some minor problems. Let's not let anyone think that Ohio's vote has some sort of problem with it.
Sure.
It doesn't. But, you know, we've reported widely on this whole Dropbox situation. That was one problem. We had some misleading mailers, misleading telephone calls, misleading information. And, you know, some of the voters reported that they felt intimidated because there were people showing up openly carrying guns at least one or two of the polling places. And voters reported that they were intimidated. We had problems with things that were being put out that weren't true and weren't being dispelled and kind of misled people. That was a huge one. And, you know, so now going into this, and the other problem we had, too, was these absentee ballot applications. People, Ohio, you have to go on the Secretary of State's website, or you have to get an application that's sent to you in the mail. Either way, you fill it out, and you have to mail it back in. Well, some people were going online, you know, printing it out, filling it, sending it back in, and then they kept getting application requests like they hadn't done that. And it was very misleading for folks. So these voter protection groups are saying what needs to happen is that the legislature needs to look at allowing more drop boxes and allowing multiple vote centers in counties, because there's so long lines. Hamilton County, your line down there sometimes was out toward the interstate. It was so long. And I know in Franklin County and Cuyahoga County, all those counties have long lines. And they're saying, well, the multiple vote centers would help. And they also want people to be able to go online and request a ballot application. None of this filling it out, sending it snail mail, getting it there. They want it to, you know, just go online and request a ballot application. So I think those things are going to be something we're going to see these advocates pushing for in the future. They've pushed for them in the past. They'll push for them in the future. But with the Republican makeup, as Karen outlined, it'll be really interesting to see how far these get.
That's Joe Ingles, reporter with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We're also joined on the phone by Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. And Karen, let's talk a little bit more about that. I wonder, was anyone surprised by the outcome of the legislative races?
Oh, I think so, because in 2018, there had been these areas that were starting to turn bluer, these suburban areas. In central Ohio, 3 Ohio House seats flipped from Republican to Democrat. There was also one in your area. Jessica Miranda had beaten incumbent Jonathan Deaver. And then up in northeast Ohio, there was a flip. So a net gain of 5 Ohio House seats in 2018. And so the question was, is that trend going to continue, or is it even a trend? And it sure looks like, as I was saying earlier, that maybe it wasn't a trend. I mean, Democrats were able to hold on to those seats, even though Republicans were targeting those seats as possible reflips. But then the House Democrats ended up losing 3 seats, the one in Appalachian, Ohio, down in southeast Ohio, the one up in Ashtabula County, and then the one in Niles. And they did pick up a seat in northeast Ohio near Cleveland in Westlake. But, you know, there's concern there. But also in the Senate side, they have definitely, Democrats have lost a seat. Sean O'Brien from northeast, the Youngstown area, lost to a Republican named Sandra O'Brien, which must have been a little confusing if you're a voter in that area. But then there is a contested race potentially in the central Ohio area where Republican State Senator Stephanie Coonsey is leading by 41 votes over her Democratic challenger. And as absentee and provisional ballots are counted 10 days after the election, that race could flip and then Democrats would be left with a wash, so to speak.
So these are some pretty significant majorities that the Republicans have in the Ohio legislature. They had a significant majority in both chambers anyway. Is there any type of indication of what the agenda might be moving forward as the new year rolls around with these new faces?
We haven't had a chance to talk to anybody regarding that right now, but I am interested because with Republicans winning the way that they did, I do wonder how that is going to affect priorities. I mean, the most obvious priority that comes to mind is the repeal of the nuclear bailout law, House Bill 6, which I think there were a lot of people wondering why that wasn't played up bigger in some of these House races, because it ended up costing Speaker Larry Householder his speakership. He was reelected to his House seat in Tuesday's election because he had no Democratic opponent. He had 4 write-ins who were opposing him, but he ended up winning. And so the priority, I'm wondering what the priority is to repeal that nuclear bailout law. And I'm also just wondering what the priority is on the issues that Joe was just talking about, on more ballot drop boxes and things that voter protection advocates want to see. So these are some interesting questions here. I should note one other thing. There was a big win for Democrats on Tuesday night in the Ohio Supreme Court race. There were 2 Ohio Supreme Court seats that were being contested. Democrats ended up winning one with Jennifer Bruner, the former Ohio Secretary of State, who won against Republican incumbent Judy French. The other race, Republican incumbent Sharon Kennedy beat Democratic challenger John O'Donnell, but this is the first time since 1993 that there have been three Democratic justices on the Ohio Supreme Court.
And we're talking with Karen Kassler and Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And before I let you all get on with your days, I know that it was your colleague Andy Chow, whom we also enjoy having on, who was covering this change and state health director. We've got a new one named by the governor recently. I hope that you all can talk a little bit about this, because this seems like a rather unorthodox choice.
Well, I'll tell you, Stephanie McLeod is currently the administrator of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation and is apparently a fairly well-liked administrator, a well-liked person in state government. She is not a doctor. She's an attorney. So I think that's one criticism that's out there. Another criticism that's out there, and it may or may not be fair, but it's been brought up. She is the daughter of Phil Burris, who used to head up Citizens for Community Values, a very conservative group that was headquartered in Cincinnati. So I think that some critics of the choice have said that they're concerned about that, but especially since the health department does have a role in abortion clinics and abortion policy in the state.
And this is coming at a time where, I mean, first of all, it's been nearly, 5 months since Dr. Amy Acton left, and there's not been a permanent person in that position since then, and we're seeing a spike in cases.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's been really difficult. There's like a tug of war here between the medical and scientific side of this and the business side of the coronavirus. And we had seen early on with Dr. Acton, the former health director, that she had a tremendous amount of problems staying in that role. People were coming to her house and protesting, armed protesters out near her house in her neighborhood. It made it very uncomfortable for her to continue to try to advocate for the medical things like masks and like social distancing and, you know, trying to keep limits on how businesses operate so that they, you know, that the spread of coronavirus isn't a huge issue in those businesses. Once she disappeared, we did see that Governor DeWine pretty much let up on a lot of the regulations that were over these businesses, and a lot of businesses came back. And for some businesses, it's close to what they had before. We've seen it elsewhere. Other places in the country, a medical director that has a medical background is usually having problems just because of this divide between the medical and the scientific part of the coronavirus and the political business part of it.
And I want to add, too, that what Joe said is absolutely right. There have been dozens of public health officials who have either resigned or retired or been fired during this pandemic because of that exact struggle. Dr. Amy Acton gave an interview to The New Yorker magazine recently and said that one of the reasons she quit was she was concerned about her ability to maintain her Hippocratic oath of doing no harm when she might have to sign public health orders that she felt did harm, because the legislature has been pushing back on the governor and the health director's authority to make some of these orders. So the next couple of months here will be very interesting as these cases continue to go up and DeWine may or may not want to take some actions. He says that Stephanie McLeod is more than up to the challenge and the possibility of criticism, so I guess we'll see.
And I want to address an email that we received from a listener named Gay. The question no one is asking is how the extremely gerrymandered districts drawn by Republicans are making Ohio seem more red than it really is. Karen, what can you tell us about the process about, redistricting in Ohio since we are just finished with a census year?
Yeah, I mean, this was the last election with the existing map, which has been criticized nationally as one of the most gerrymandered, if not the most gerrymandered in the country. The process to draw new maps will begin once we find out if we maintain our 16 congressional districts or if we actually lose a seat. And it sure looks like the possibility that we may lose a seat is there. If that happens, what will be very interesting to watch is how the Republicans, who will control the process, decide which seat will go. Will it be one of their own members or will it be one of the four Democrats? And now, the new process that voters approved a couple years ago does require more bipartisan buy-in and minority party agreement to the final maps. But but it doesn't give the minority party as much power as the majority party does. And so that's one of the arguments that has been that was in play on the Ohio Supreme Court race, because the Supreme Court could potentially weigh in on whether the maps that are drawn are fair. And so it's going to be quite a battle, I think, coming up, especially if we lose a congressional seat.
And we know that you all will be here to talk to us about it as it happens. I want to thank Joe Ingles and Karen Kassler from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau for being with us today. Have a great weekend, Joe and Karen. Appreciate it very much.
You too. Thanks.
You too.
And up next, even a $90 million war chest wasn't enough to help Democrat Amy McGrath in her attempt to take down Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And Kentucky voters extended the supermajority of the Republicans in the state legislature there as well. We look south next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Let's talk about a tighter grip on power for Republicans in Kentucky. The Weekly News Review continues now as we're joined from Lexington by Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRocher. He's on the phone with us. Daniel, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you as always. And from Louisville via Zoom, Courier Journal reporter Joe Sonka. Joe, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, Daniel, I want to start with you. And actually, I probably should start by reading a tweet from Senator Mitch McConnell, because he's very interested in having us read this tweet, apparently, based on the press conference that he just wrapped up this morning. He says, quote, "Here's how this must work in our great country. Every legal vote should be counted. Any illegally submitted ballots must not. All sides must get to observe the process, and the courts are here to apply the laws and resolve disputes. That's how Americans' votes decide the result." And Daniel, I believe that you watched this press conference that the Senate Majority Leader had here in Kentucky just this morning, and he would not answer further questions about President Trump's, I guess, recent remarks about the outcome of the election so far as we know it. He continued to refer reporters to this very tweet. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I was there. I mean, when Senator McConnell doesn't want to answer a question, Senator McConnell doesn't answer a question. So he was asked this question probably in at least 11 different ways, where people were basically just trying to get him to weigh in on the fact that President Trump has made these unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud. And if you remember, I mean, we were kind of in a similar situation last year in 2019 when Governor Matt Bevin made unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud. At that point, McConnell basically said, no, it looks like Matt Bevin lost. He would not go that far today. And this is kind of the line he's been maintaining all week, basically saying that if there's any dispute about this election, it'll be decided by the courts and not by him. That said, you know, there are a lot of Republicans across the country who are really denouncing the way that the president is talking about this election, saying that it undermines the integrity of the process. McConnell's not doing that.
This press conference involved some state legislators as well. I mean, was this just a victory lap for Republicans in Kentucky?
Yeah, I mean, they're feeling themselves right now. They just they put out a little piece of paper where they were showing that they have basically as big of margins as the Democrats had back in 1984. They've got super majorities in both chambers. They didn't lose any incumbency, so they only picked up seats. And so they are really kind of flexing their muscle. It's going to be a very interesting legislative session when the Republicans are able to flex their muscles in this way.
And we're going to talk more about that momentarily. I want to bring in Joe Sonka now, though. Mitch McConnell is still in power, Joe, because he easily defeated Democrat Amy McGrath in the election, and she was able to raise a substantial amount of money from a lot of people across the country who were interested in seeing Mitch McConnell defeated. But this race ultimately wasn't even close.
Yep, no, it was not close at all. People, I don't think a lot of people thought that McGrath was going to win, but I think a lot of people thought that it might be within 10 points or so. And of course, McConnell won by over 20 percentage points. It was an absolute blowout. McGrath won Lexington and Louisville, which everyone expected, but it wasn't by a gigantic margin. And the only other county she won, I believe, was Franklin County by a slight amount, where Frankfort is. So it was an absolute blowout. And Mitch McConnell ran up the margin in all of these rural counties throughout Kentucky. Kentucky's a very rural state and conservative state, and they came out to vote for Donald Trump, and they came out to vote for Mitch McConnell with him.
So, Joe, we're seeing this conversation take place nationally already. Of course, we're not even sure who won the presidency just yet, but I need to note that we're saying that at 12:32 p.m. on Friday, just in case you're listening to a replay later on. So, we're seeing a lot of conversation about the Democrats and their messaging and what type of candidate would be more successful in whatever type of race. And Amy McGrath faced a tough primary challenge from someone to her left in state representative out of Louisville, Charles Booker. And I'm wondering if you're hearing any rumblings about, you know, the way we heard Bernie would have won back in 2016, if Booker would have won, is kind of a sentiment that's being expressed at all.
Yeah, you see a lot of that on social media, people that supported Booker who said that he would have, he might not have won the race, but he might have made it more competitive. And people are urging the Democratic Party to, some people are urging the Democratic Party to move in that direction to give them a fighting chance. But Democrats are in such a hole right now. They're looking at a 75 seat to 25 seat minority in the state house. Huge majority, Republican supermajority in the Senate. And they're really at a point where over the next few months and next few years, Democrats in Kentucky are going to have to strategize how they can become politically relevant again, because the only real relevancy the party has in Kentucky is a governor who won by a hair last year that really only won because of the anomaly of Matt Bevin. He was so uniquely unpopular that he was able to win. And of course, John Yarmuth in the congressional seat in Louisville. But besides that, it's not an environment where Democrats are competitive.
Joe, I'm seeing a lot of analysis comparing President Trump, should he lose, to Matt Bevin, right? This sort of outside Republican candidate who was a business guy and full of bluster and was able to get elected once, but then when the time came around for re-election, was defeated while members of his own party did cruise to re-election. And I mean, are you hearing that too?
Yeah, it's like national politics kind of follows whatever happened in Kentucky the year before. We had Matt Bevin winning in 2015. Nobody expected it. The polls didn't expect it, but something was happening that the pollsters couldn't find, and that's what happened with Donald Trump when he was elected in 2016. You had their personalities were extremely brash all throughout their terms. That eventually led to Matt Bevin being defeated, even though it's a very Republican state, and it looks like Donald Trump is just going to come up just a hair short. And there's even on the way out, Bevin, as Daniel mentioned, Bevin made unsubstantiated claims about voter irregularities, and he had supporters making really wild conspiracy theories without any evidence. And that's what we're starting to get right now on the national level as Trump tries to fight to stay in the White House.
And let's bring Daniel DeRochers from Lexington Herald Leader back into the conversation. Daniel, I spoke with a Northern Kentucky state representative just on Thursday evening, Rachel Roberts, a Democrat out of Newport, and asked her about what she thinks they're going to be able to accomplish, if anything. And so she pivoted immediately to like the things that you can work on with Republicans. So it just seems like Democrats have no plan for any type of Democratic agenda because there's no reason to have one at this point. What are you hearing from Democrats in the state legislature as they head into a new year and a new session of the General Assembly with very little presence?
Yeah, I mean, basically at this point, all they can do is play defense and try to, you know, maybe get on some Republicans that bills that are passed. I mean, I think that this session is really going to be a beat-up Andy Beshear session. The governor, you know, in his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, both saw a lot of popularity. That popularity has, of course, dipped over the course of the pandemic. But Republicans really weren't satisfied with how he handled it, some of the things he was doing. And so, you know, at this press conference today, you know, Speaker Osborne and Senate President Stivers went right after Beshear and his handling of the pandemic. So it seems like they're really going to try and curb executive power. You know, in many ways, the Democrats are just going to be irrelevant, right? That's what happens when you have a supermajority with one party controlling things. And, you know, Stivers pointed out today that there are more Republican senators. There are only 38 senators in the Senate in Kentucky. There are more Republican state senators than there are Democrats in the House of Representatives. And so that's just a kind of pretty stark illustration of how little Democrats will be able to have any influence in this session.
Can you expand at all on what they hope to accomplish, the Republicans hope to accomplish, related to, I guess, reining in, as they characterize, the executive powers of Governor Beshear that have been exhibited during the course of this pandemic?
Basically, they want to be able to put a check on him, right? They want him to have to go through the legislature before he does some of the things that he does. And so we don't really know, you know, they haven't had their retreats yet, so we don't really know what type of bill they're going to lay out, and we don't know the exact details of it, but it's going to be something that makes it harder for him to kind of do universal executive orders or executive orders that last for a long period of time without their say. And it's going to be kind of odd because we only have a part-time legislature. I mean, they only come in for 60 days in even-numbered years and 30 days in odd-numbered years. And so navigating how you give the legislature that kind of check and balance is going to be somewhat difficult.
Joe Sanka is a reporter with the Courier Journal. These promises to take on the governor's response to COVID-19 are coming as we're seeing record days of single-day counts of COVID-19 cases in Kentucky, more than 2,300 on Thursday alone. Can you describe for us the situation of COVID in Kentucky right now?
Yeah, it's just continuing to spike upward and upward. It's we're seeing more cases than we've ever seen before. We're seeing more hospitalizations than we have ever seen before. We're seeing more deaths than we've ever seen before. And right now, our Supreme Court is going to decide if a lot of these emergency regulations that Governor Beshear has signed are going to stay in effect, or whether they will be struck down, as the Republican Attorney General and many Republicans in Frankfurt want to see. Now, if that's the case, and Kentucky has even less regulations in place while COVID is spiking, that this could be a really, really serious situation. And even if the Supreme Court does uphold Governor Beshear's emergency regulations, again, you have that huge Republican supermajority coming into session in January, and that might be the very first thing on their agenda. And that's what I'm hearing from Republicans, is that's number one, is reining in Governor Beshear on what he can do with COVID.
And Daniel, I know that you track COVID as well, and we're seeing this spike in cases across the Commonwealth. Here in Northern Kentucky, three counties are now listed red zone: Boone, Kenton, and Campbell. That means that they are averaging 25 or more daily cases per 100,000 people. Thursday brought Northern Kentucky's highest single day count since this pandemic began. But I'm wondering if when a county is turned to red zone, there are 9 recommendations that the governor has, the state has, for counties to follow. They're not mandates, they're recommendations. And I guess I'm leading to a question about contact tracing and where the cases are emerging from. But first, I just want to set it up, because one of those recommendations is not to eat in the restaurants anymore. Just get carry out if you can. Again, not a mandate, it's a recommendation. But we're hearing from state and health officials that this spike that we're experiencing across the state is primarily related to private gatherings. And so I've not been able to really reconcile the recommendation not to be eating at restaurants if they're not suggesting that the cases are coming from restaurants, that they're coming from private gatherings. What have you learned about where they're seeing these cases emerge?
Yeah, I mean, the cases are all over the place, right? When we have numbers this high, they're coming from all over the place. You know, in Lexington, they're even having problems where they contact trace and people are just not listening to them. And so I think what we're really seeing is just this COVID fatigue, where people are unfortunately saying that they're basically done with the pandemic, right? So if you limit people from going to restaurants, they go and have a dinner party, right? There's just no way to really tamp this down unless people start taking it seriously. And it just doesn't feel like that's what's going on, right? One of my colleagues, Alex Acquisto, she interviewed a business owner out in eastern Kentucky who was trying to enforce the mask mandate. And then when he enforced the mask mandate, his revenue declined by about 30% because people just stopped showing up to his business. And so it's really a matter of personal responsibility more than anything at this point, right? We kind of know this at this stage in the pandemic, what are the actions that are going to be more safe, more unsafe? And then you have to make your choices accordingly. And it just seems like people are not making the choices that they need to be making right now.
And Joe, we did hear about, you know, the Republicans in the legislature looking to curb some of the power or the authority of the governor when they get the opportunity, when the session returns, when the General Assembly returns. But are you hearing anything at all about any shutdown measures? I mean, we are seeing so many more cases now than we did back at the beginning. And, you know, we're still on a recommendation status now rather than mandates outside of the masks.
Yeah, Governor Beshear keeps saying that he thinks at this point that he can get more compliance by kind of asking nicely than telling people that he thinks that if you enforce this, then people are going to be more likely to resist it than if you recommend it, than they would be if you just recommended them. But if cases keep going up and keep going up and hospitals start filling up, he might have to kind of recalculate like how he's viewing this pandemic.
Oh, it just seems like every day since July, the governor has come out to this daily press conference to say it's another difficult day in Kentucky. And so it's not getting better. What should we expect over the coming days? I mean, now that we see the balance of power has not shifted at all as far as the legislature goes, Daniel, do we think it's just going to be business as usual through the end of the year?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, so things are just going to get harder from here, right? It's going to get colder. And, you know, when things get colder, some people tend to move inside. Being outside has been a way that people have been able to meet and gather, and that's going to be a lot harder. You know, you've got the holidays, you've got Thanksgiving, you've got Christmas, time when people want to meet up with their extended family and see things. So I think we're just kind of in for a rough winter at this point. You know, obviously, Senator McConnell's been talking a lot about how there's a Manhattan-esque project to try and get a vaccine, and a vaccine will certainly help. But it seems like we're still a while away from being able to have kind of a semblance of how things used to be before this pandemic hit.
Well, we may be in for a rough winter, but I hope the two of you have a lovely weekend. I'm so grateful for the time you gave us on this Friday. Daniel DeRocher is from the Lexington Herald Leader and Joe Sonka from the Courier Journal in Louisville. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We heard a lot about the suburbs during the presidential campaign and the threat to prosperity they would face if Democrat Joe Biden were to be elected. But local suburbs are already in decline and seeing a growth in poverty, and one has a plan to address it. WCPO reporter Lucy May is with us now via Zoom. Lucy, welcome back to our show.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I thought this was really good timing to explore poverty in the suburbs because of these vague references that President Trump was making during the campaign that the suburbs would be in trouble if Democrats came into power. But it looks like around here anyway, suburbs are already struggling in a lot of ways that inner cities do. What can you tell us about that before we dive into the plan involving one of our communities?
Sure. This is actually a trend that has been happening for the past 20 years throughout the nation, and that is poverty. The number of people living below the federal poverty line has been growing much faster in the suburbs over the past 20 years than it has been in the cities and rural communities. And this is really interesting. I think when most people think of poverty, they think of inner cities, they think of maybe distant rural communities, but they don't think a lot about the suburbs. And while the city of Cincinnati clearly still has a large number of people living in poverty within the city limits, some research that a national expert did for WCPO found that between 2000 and 2019, the population of people living below the federal poverty line within the city of Cincinnati decreased by 3%. The population of people living below the federal poverty line increased in the rest of Hamilton County by 74% during that same time frame. So you can really see how poverty is shifting. There are a ton of different reasons for that. But suburbs and suburban communities are definitely seeing growing poverty in their communities and trying to figure out how to address it, because a lot of the social services and agencies that help people in poverty are located in the cities. So it makes it kind of a tricky proposition for suburban communities.
I note that one of the women that you talked to who's dealing with some money issues right now because of the pandemic lives in Wyoming, a community
right.
that I think a lot of us might initially think of as not having many problems at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that just speaks to the idea that this really is widespread.
Yes. Yes, it definitely is. And she's somebody who has a great job. She works at Cincinnati Children's. She earns $15.33 an hour, which is, you know, well above minimum wage. But her hours got cut in half because of the pandemic. So all of a sudden, she was working more than full time. She said she could pick up as many hours as she wanted at Cincinnati Children's. But since the pandemic, instead of working 40 plus hours a week, she's working 20 hours a week. And so she reached out to the Cincinnati Hamilton County Community Action Agency and got some rental assistance. They ended up covering her full $900 October rent payment. Again, she's paying $900 a month in rent, which is not, you know, a cheap amount to pay in rent by any means. She's living in a nice place. But she needed that help. And the communities are seeing more and more of their neighbors who are in that same boat.
We're talking with Lucy May from WCPO. And so you explore one of our local communities, Silverton, and they have a plan to try to address the situation that they're facing. And I know that you spoke with Tom Carroll, who is mm-hmm. the village administrator there. We've had him on this program multiple times. He's always doing a lot of research and publishing materials. And it's a great conversation about first ring suburbs, which is what Silverton is. What can you tell us about his plan there?
Well, first, I will give a shout out to you because I heard Tom Carroll talking about the research that he did with his daughter on Cincinnati Edition.
How about that?
Yes. And I had actually just pitched the suburban poverty story to my bosses and said, oh, Michael beat me to it. He's talking to Tom Carroll about this. But what Tom Carroll, you mentioned him, he has done a lot of research on poverty, specifically eviction rates in Silverton. He became very interested in this and has really done some terrific research showing just how poverty and eviction rates have increased in Hamilton County's first ring suburbs, those communities just outside the city of Cincinnati. And that makes a big difference because, as he points out, you know, the municipalities rely on revenues that their residents generate. So if their residents are suffering, that's not great for the budget. That's they need to have healthy communities all the way around. So he has two really interesting ideas. Now, Silverton's council has not approved these yet. I talked to some council members who are in favor of them, but they'll be talking about these programs as part of their 2021 budget deliberations. So these aren't done deals yet, but his ideas would be to reduce eviction rates in Silverton by having Silverton's own kind of rental assistance program to help cover rent. He found, which he talked about, I think, during the program that you had him on, that most evictions in Silverton are for rent that needs back rent that is overdue for $1,000 or less. So he feels like they can really kind of put a dent in evictions by dedicating some funding to helping people who are otherwise very stable families and just need this little hand up, this 1 month rent to kind of get past whatever crisis they've hit and avoid eviction. And eviction, of course, can just spiral families and individuals into terrible problems. So the more his ideas, the more evictions you can avoid, the better for the community. The other program he's suggesting is more for homeowners, and he thinks of it as a housing stabilization program. We've done some other reporting on the fact that especially elderly homeowners, when they, you know, who have limited incomes, when their homes start to need major repairs, like a new roof or a brand new paint job, or the lady we talked to had a detached garage that needed to be demolished behind her house, those sometimes have price tags that people on fixed or limited incomes cannot afford. And Silverton's an older community. They have a lot of homeowners who've been there for a very long time. And he's got this innovative idea of basically allowing the village to loan homeowners, low-income homeowners, the money that they would need to make these repairs And then there would be a lien on the house for that amount so that once the home gets sold eventually, whether that's in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years or whatever, the village would be repaid. So it would essentially create kind of a revolving loan fund to help these low to moderate income homeowners. It would be income qualified. The repairs could range anywhere from like $1,000 to $10,000 per house. So, you know, it could make a big difference to homeowners like the lady that I spoke to for this story who needed some major repairs done to her house. She got some help from friends and neighbors before this program. You know, it's not approved yet, so she didn't benefit from this program specifically. But she's the kind of homeowner who could benefit and said that she was really delighted that Silverton was thinking about these approaches and really wanted to help the community in this way.
So, Lucy, we note that this is a proposal from the village administrator, and it does require council approval. What's the feeling you're getting from members of council?
Well, the members of council that I spoke to were very supportive. I spoke to a lady who's been on council for many, many years, and she said that, hey, we need to help our neighbors. Shirley Hackett Austin is her name. She's a retired educator. And she said that, you know, we are a small, close-knit community. We live next to these folks who are experiencing these problems. And you know, when you know the people who are struggling, you want to help them. So she feels like it's the right thing to do. I also talked to Mark Corey, who was, he's been on Silverton's council since 1999. And he liked the ideas, too. He said, you know, he doesn't want the eviction prevention program to take away from other city services. There are lots of basic services that Silverton has to provide. But they both at least seem to feel like there's a lot of potential in these ideas.
Lucy, in this story, you write about how the Community Action Agency is helping families in the suburbs and the city, of course. But a quarter of the people that they're supporting are outside the city. They're in the county as it relates to energy assistance and rental assistance. According to your reporting, 30% of the families the agency is helping through this child poverty initiative also in the suburbs. Was there anything that led anyone to express surprise about the numbers coming out of the suburbs today?
Well, the people who are actually offering these services are not surprised. I talked to Mark Lawson at Community Action Agency before he was the CEO there. He was an attorney with Legal Aid for many years. And so folks who do this work have been watching these trends for a very long time. So they're not surprised that they're seeing growing need in the suburbs. I think what worries them is that, you know, the suburbs, so many people and families were hit hard during the Great Recession in 2007, 2008. And the suburbs actually, suburban poverty actually had a harder time coming out of that than poverty in the city. And I should say that, so people experiencing poverty who were really hit hard by the Great Recession, the city recovered much more quickly than families and individuals in the suburbs. Some of those families and individuals were still recovering from the Great Recession when the COVID-19 crisis hit. So there's a real concern that this is really going to hurt families who are still recovering from the Great Recession. And, you know, those folks who never thought of themselves as needing help before the Great Recession, now there are a whole lot of them who are kind of being hit by this double whammy.
Any indication about an increased need for help as the holidays near?
Yes, there definitely is. I know I spoke with folks at St. Vincent de Paul who said they're seeing intense demand for help for the holidays. I know all the organizations that I've talked to recently for a variety of stories are very, very worried about what this is going to mean, you know, not only for holidays and gifts and fun stuff for the kids, but just for people being able to stay warm and keep the lights on as it gets colder outside.
Lucy May is a reporter at WCPO. Lucy, we always love having you on. Thanks for spending a little bit of your Friday with us.
Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. Although you're probably on another website right now, refreshing, refreshing, refreshing the electoral vote as we await final word on who the next president will be. I'm Michael Monks. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back again on Monday. Talk to you then.